You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Fiction podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that nearly every issue that shows up in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanandan, also known as Sugi, the author of the novel Love Marriage, and I'm a Pisces. What? That was hard for me. I don't usually talk about this.
I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant and a Libra.
Do you even wonder why you even know that? I mean, do you believe in horoscopes? Do you get your palms read?
No. I am a very anti-superstition person. I believe in choices.
But you know your sign.
Yeah. What are we going to do about that? I mean, you want me to sing Age of Aquarius?
I was thinking more of this. Fate. That's what I wanted to talk about this week. Fate versus agency. We're not going to have a news peg because fate doesn't need a news peg because it contains all of us. Although you could say that every news story you've read since November 9th, 2016 has been worried about the struggle between fate and agency. Was it Hillary's fault? Was it Facebook's fault? Was it our fault? Or are we just arrogant fools to imagine that we have control over what happens to us and our country?
Meaning, are we fated to be doing this podcast?
Oh, we're totally fated to be doing this podcast. At the end of the semester, with the theses, the MFA theses, piled around my desk like tall, late May snowdrifts, because I live in Minnesota and we have recently had May and April snow.
I'm sorry.
It's kind of the pits. One begins to wonder about fate, which is why this week we've brought in the poet and nonfiction writer Megan O'Rourke to talk about the role fate plays in her work. And first, we're going to talk to the writer Jess Rao, author of the critically acclaimed 2014 novel Your Face and Mine, and the forthcoming essay collection White Flights, which is coming out from Grey Wolf in 2019. Jess, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Jess, how you doing?
Hi, Whitney. How are you?
So Sugi starts talking to me about how she's noticing more and more people whom she's running into are interested in the sort of the arcane, the superstitious readings that determine your future, tarot cards, horoscopes, the Ouija board, which James Merrill wrote about in a different age. But before we get into the possible causes for this phenomenon, can we just discuss to what extent this actually is a phenomenon?
Yes, I was just at a reading last week for Alexander Chee's new essay collection. And the first thing he spoke about was tarot cards, actually. And he took some questions from the audience, and they had a long discussion about experts in tarot cards. This is something I know absolutely nothing about. So it's striking to me. And I think your observation is very much on point that, you know, we live in an age of tremendous uncertainty. And at times like that, any kind of, you know, provisional device, which is sort of what tarot is,
right?
You know, becomes sort of, you know, for writers, it becomes interesting, maybe not, you know, taken literally, but, you know, it's, I mean, essentially what tarot is a kind of, it's not so much a, I mean, it is a, tarot is a, as I understand it, is predictive, but it's also about interpretation. It's sort of like the I Ching
yeah.
in that way. It's about interpreting the present as much as it is about just laying out, you know, the timeline of the future.
I'm related to a lot of people who feel strongly about horoscopes and auspicious times and your star chart, etc. And which, at least in the Hindu traditions in which I was raised, are sometimes important. And then a member of our family, before their wedding, had her star chart read by one person and then kind of forgot some things and wanted to have it read again and had it read again by a different person and got a set of different answers. And the older generation of my family was sort of like, shrug, no, this doesn't surprise us. This doesn't trouble us. And I had never really thought about the importance of the interpretation before that. And they were just really, they sort of were like, this is, well, that's what happens. That's how it goes. It doesn't matter who actually reads the cards, and it doesn't mean that either one of those things was wrong.
Right. Right.
Well, there's kind of been a literary tradition in this. I mean, I think about, I don't know if it's exactly the same thing, but Yeats was interested in the occult. You know, he was interested in that automatic writing business. You know, I mean, you can look at Sylvia Plath has written, you know, she wrote about Ouija, the Ouija board, along with Merrill. I wonder why, you know, like it's a particular thing that that comes into vogue with writers at certain different times, you know. I guess I'm curious as to why it would be in vogue now.
This is a time when there's a tremendous sense that, you know, that the flow of time itself has changed. I mean, and I'm talking about sort of cultural, political, historical time.
Mm.
And this is something I've been writing about in my sort of very tail end revisions of White Flights, trying to bring in a little bit more of the sense that, you know, after the 2016 election, there really was a sense of an eruption in time. There was a sense of a kind of a violation of what a lot of people perceived as sort of the arc of history. And I'm using that term for Martin Luther King, you know, the arc of history, best justice. So, you know, I think in a kind of casual way, a lot of people maybe had heard that phrase or something like it, and just especially people who considered themselves to be politically progressive, you know, and just in terms of the word progressive itself, they considered themselves to be people who were riding the train of progress.
Yes.
And that it was going to take us somewhere.
It's so interesting because that directly relates to this, some stuff that we've talked about on the podcast about the politics of inevitability versus the politics of eternity. Leaders like someone like Putin or Trump being politicians who practice the politics of eternity, meaning they want stasis. They want to end progress. They don't.
Yeah.
And so there actually is an actual movement against this idea that history bends toward progress and things get better, that there's an actual resistance against that progress in time that's happening right now.
Is that Timothy Snyder?
Yes.
You know, in a sense, we could say there's three different general sort of schemas that are all competing for attention. So there's, you know, the idea of progressive time, that is that there's an arc of history and that things are slowly getting better. There's, you know, what Whitney was talking about, sort of citing Timothy Snyder, this idea of, you know, people who of stasis or eternity, of not, you know, of sort of a restoring a, you know, what's supposed to be an eternal order of some kind.
Right.
And then there's also apocalyptic time, which is, you know,
always, not that time.
Always very much present in Western culture, but intensely present now because of the sense of ecological apocalypse, which, you know, I think the sense of ecological apocalypse is, it's not that it's overstated, but it's vague and all-encompassing enough to take on the sort of traditional Western quality of the end of days, which is a, you know, basic sort of formulation of Western culture and aesthetics that goes all the way back to the beginnings of Christianity. A lot of people who would define themselves as progressive or liberal or even leftist are in this weird position today of being simultaneously optimists and catastrophists, you know, in the sense that, like, you still want to believe in political progress and change and hope. On the other hand, you think that the climate is essentially dooming us, and, you know, the whole of human civilization may be gone in 100 years.
So in the middle of this discussion, when Sugi and I were first talking about this topic, you know, well, there's a phrase that I remembered that you talk about, something called white dream time. Could you talk about that concept?
Yeah. So what I meant, this is something that I use in Your Face and Mine as a way of talking about my own experience. Really, you know, when I say white dream time, I'm talking about the ability to distance oneself from a feeling that you're in any kind of personal danger, or even that political or social forces affect you directly. I grew up in high school. I was living in Baltimore, and you know, Baltimore is a majority Black city, and I was heavily involved in social movements and in food pantry and in listening to a lot of hip hop music. And you know, that was what Baltimore was as a place. And then I went to Yale, and it wasn't just that Yale was overwhelmingly white, though it was. It was a way in which the politics and the aesthetics of the city, hip hop, graffiti, all those kinds of things that were going on in the early 90s, were just not part of the world of Yale. And I felt sort of ridiculous bringing them with me. And so I sort of dropped them, because that's something that white people can do. Pick up an aesthetic and then drop it if it doesn't feel right, or if it doesn't feel convenient, or if it doesn't feel quote unquote authentic. And I went back into what I would call a kind of a white dream time, which is essentially a kind of a state of wishful thinking. And it had a real hold on me. And it wasn't until in my mid 20s, when I was going to graduate school in creative writing, that I started reading and listening to James Baldwin, who talks about white dream time very directly. He calls it the sunlit prison. That's his phrase of the white American experience, that I realized sort of what had happened to me.
That's so interesting. I think one of the reasons that, I mean, one way that this is happening now, or happened, you know, with the election of Donald Trump, was that when he was voted into the White House, a lot of very literate, very educated people, particularly people in the media, which is, of course, dominated by people of privilege and white Americans, a lot of those people felt for the first time that they were no longer in control of the world. And I think I was also surprised. I think I wasn't as surprised as some other folks. But, you know, I heard sort of repeatedly this narrative, you know, these folks had done everything right. They'd gone to good schools, bought the right furniture, lived in the right neighborhoods, read the right books. And yet suddenly they were no longer masters of their own fate. You cannot be guaranteed good test results or a good result. And so they, you know, here are the tarot cards. And of course, I know people who turn to those cards for other reasons, but there do also seem to be people who are surfacing talk of fate as a way to deal with their own responsibility or lack thereof.
Yeah, I mean, I was surrounded by that feeling too. And I think it's instructive to go back and look at the Saturday Night Live skit that with Dave Chappelle that aired the weekend after the election, where Dave Chappelle is a guest in a house full of white liberals at a party that's supposed to be celebrating Hillary Clinton's election.
Right.
We watch as the sort of crisis unfolds, and Dave Chappelle the whole time is sort of sitting back with this very sardonic look on his face, basically saying, you know, the Klan guy is going to get elected. Like, if you put a Klan guy on the ballot, I forget exactly what phrase he uses, but, you know, if you put a white supremacist on the ballot, he's going to win. So, I mean, I would say that a sense of political and racial, for lack of a better word, a sense of an emergency began in August of 2014 with Michael Brown's death, with Michael Brown's murder,
right,
and the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement. And what was striking to me at that time, this is also the exact same moment that my novel was published, what was striking to me at that time was that when Trayvon Martin was murdered, you know, when there were other police killings, it had been in the news for maybe a week or two, and then the news cycle had moved beyond it. And what happened in August of 2014 was that the news cycle never moved beyond it. There was, you know, there was Eric Garner, there was another case and another case, and then there was the Black Lives Matter movement, which became, you know, a mass movement. And there was this sense in which a feeling of, you know, a feeling of national emergency around, you know, that feels like an awkward phrase, but to me, it's really, it's the sort of phrase that sums it up in the sense of crisis. What I'm really talking about is crisis.
Yeah. And the connection that I feel like is a little bit like when you start talking about Black Lives Matter and Trayvon Martin and police killings, right? What, you know, and I think Sugi's question is trying to get at this also, you know, I feel like, you know, you and I, Jess, went to really nice, and so did Sugi for that matter. She probably went to a better school than we did. We all went to nice schools, right? But there's a sense and a belief that, and I think this is particularly true for white Americans like me, that you have, that your individual choices give you agency. And
sure.
When you are a minority population in America, you don't feel that way. And police killings are an expression of the of white authority saying, like, you don't have agency, right? You're subject to our power. I mean, in a very bleak and just direct way, right?
Yeah.
And then when
yeah.
Trump gets elected, when we're talking about the media and people, he starts to attack media. He starts to attack white wealthy, educated elites in a way that white, wealthy, educated elites have not been attacked before. And they start to feel, hey, we're not in charge. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, yeah,
that,
yeah.
That's the connection that I think is part of what's happening here. Does that make sense to you?
It does. You know, I think it's really interesting to go back and listen to some lectures that Cornel West gave in the sort of in the mid 2000s called The Gifts of Black Folk in an Age of Terrorism, where he's really talking about post 9/11 America. And he talks about the ways in which the Black American experience of essentially the experience of suffering and, you know, the experience of utter marginalization and dehumanization is very instructive in post 9/11 America. Forgive me for I'm quoting the words he uses. He talks about it as niggerization. That's the word he uses for the experience of Americans after 9/11 in the sense of transforming, you know, Americans into a population that feels vulnerable, that feels under attack, that
yes.
feels why do they hate us? And I think in some ways the roots of this present political moment can be traced back to not only the 2008 financial crisis, which really all that really did was it just pushed forward the process of transforming most Americans into financially precarious and vulnerable citizens because of historical forces like the collapse of unions and et cetera. But also 9/11 as a decisive moment where Americans as a whole population felt under attack for the first time. And so that, you know, this process of turning white Americans in particular into people who felt under attack, who felt financially precarious. And then, you know, I would say what happened in the Black Lives Matter movement, and this has been borne out by sociologists and, you know, reporters and other people, especially after 2016, is, you know, there was this moment where the optimism around Obama and the sense that, like, race relations had really reached a turning point with the 2008 election, it really turned after 2014 because there was this sense that the Black Lives Matter movement was, quote unquote, racially dividing America again. And what, you know, I think in some sense, like what that did is it created the sense of white racial vulnerability and victimization that Trump sensed and maximized.
Yeah. I think, you know, the idea of this, getting back to the tarot cards and that sort of stuff, when people feel powerless, which I think is a new experience for many white Americans, at least within, you know, current memory, right? I mean, you could say that experience happened in the Great Depression as well, perhaps. But when people feel powerless, they turn to other narratives to try to make sense of it, conspiracy theories Sure. or whatever.
Yeah, I think that also, I mean, a lot of these traditions are, they're also traditions that other communities have turned to for much longer. And I mean, there are, now, I can't speak authoritatively about like sort of the use of horoscopes in all American communities, but I mean, some of this seems to me like in general, so much of the rhetoric of individuality and individualism and free will and our ability to pursue happiness, et cetera, is built into the very foundation of American governing American documents. And I wonder about the ways that that's seeped into our conversations about American storytelling, like the idea that it seems to me like white Americans are new to thinking of themselves as a collective, even though, of course, they have been a collective power all along. And other communities have thought of themselves as communities, perhaps for much longer, and have had to, and also have told their stories in those ways, which maybe in some ways these traditions help with. And I think, you know, of course, this also has to do with questions of like blame and responsibility when we talk about individuals, right? I mean, I can think of like, for example, like a relative of mine who, if I like sort of tell them a story about, gosh, so many of my relatives appear in this podcast as the relative who sort of says, well, you know, couldn't you have done this? Couldn't you have done that? And at first, I used to sort of be like, yeah, I guess I could have done that. And then eventually I sort of realized that a lot of the conversation in response to the stories I was telling were about ways that I could fix the situation, but I often wasn't in positions to fix situations that I was telling them about because of a marginalized position or an entrenched structure that didn't give me room to move. And so I've become really interested in the ways in which we tell the stories of communities and collectives in America. Like, how does we operate? And then also, how do we tell the stories of people who have agency, but maybe a different kind of agency than the kind that has come to the forefront traditionally of American fiction? I mean, this isn't necessarily right. Like, I mean, how do we think about that?
Yeah. Yeah. So that, I mean, this is one of the main themes of my book of essays, White Flights, where you have in white American fiction of the last 40 or 50 years, there's such an emphasis on the individual, and particularly emphasis on narratives in which individuals are essentially alone. They're isolated, whether by a kind of literary device, like in Raymond Carver's stories, or they're, you know, geographically, physically isolated, say in a book like Jim Harrison's Legends of the Fall or Cormac McCarthy's The Road, where you literally have like one person in an empty, you know, supposedly empty landscape. And to me, the way I describe this is as this almost an obsession with the idea of the autonomy of the imagination. And this is something that a lot of scholars have written about, the way in which the white American imagination imagines itself as essentially standing as an individual mind against an empty landscape. And the empty landscape draws attention to the individual mind with a kind of a sharp perspective or sharp relief. And of course, that's a fantasy. The idea of the autonomy of the imagination is a fantasy. On the other hand, fiction by people of color often gets read and interpreted as entirely an expression of a kind of ethnographic or sociological reality. And that also is a fantasy and a total misreading of the fiction of somebody like Sandra Cisneros or Toni Morrison or Juno Diaz or John Edgar Wideman. But it really, you know, it's a kind of a, you know, for lack of a better word, it's a kind of a literary apartheid that to some degree, I think, has broken down in the last decade or decade and a half, but still very much operates. I think if you go out into the world of American fiction in terms of, you know, bookstores and book clubs and book reviewers and interviewers and you know, even other podcasts, there's still this kind of reflexive dividing, division, I should say, between the way that white writers are interpreted and talked about, and the way that writers of color are interpreted and talked about, and also expected to operate. That is the way that they're expected to write. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Well, I think that Suki and I, you know, both studied with James McPherson, and McPherson was, you know, someone who talked about this all the time, and was sort of very, I mean, he was incredibly influential for me because he said, you should not do that. You should not live in a white apartheid literary world. You should write about race. You look at Melville, look at what these other writers have done, and look at how important this is in American life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, my writing career wouldn't exist without that. But I sort of think about Kansas City as a community. So you can't, I realized at a certain point, like, you can't think about Kansas City just from a white perspective, or you're not really thinking about the city.
Right. And I write about James Allen McPherson in the book. You know, I didn't go to Iowa. I never met him. I never studied with him. What fascinates me about him is primarily his short story Elbow Room, which I think is just one of the great short stories, great fictional texts in the American literary tradition. But it was the end of his life as a fiction writer. It was the last thing he wrote. Or the last thing he published. He may have written fiction after that, but the last piece of fiction he published, and he was only in his mid-30s, and this is in the late 1970s. And then he went on to have this decades-long teaching career, and he wrote a lot of nonfiction. But Elbow Room is this very interesting text, a very interesting story. It's about an interracial marriage in the 1970s that goes awry, you know, that is... a failed relationship, and a kind of a cultural failure, a cultural impasse. And, you know, that text is that story is in some ways...
Do you read it as an impasse? Because I always sort of read it more optimistically than that.
Well, you know, it has both within it optimism and, you know, I think optimism and pessimism, it has a kind of catastrophic quality, and it also has a kind of, you know, I can't go on, I'll go on quality. It has both those things, but it's the last thing he wrote. He stopped, you know, he was such a gifted writer, and he was the, you know, exemplar of this tradition of Ralph Ellison and, you know, Stanley Crouch and Albert Murray and all these people who were sort of in his intellectual world. But it was the last, you know, it was the dagger in his career.
You know, I frequently teach that story, and I taught it this semester and actually gave it to my workshop after the election. I was teaching at Iowa and gave it to my workshop. And I love giving people that story because it's a very brave story in its form and in its content. And also it contains so much about both these individuals who are choosing in their individual lives to operate in certain ways, but it does also address community in some ways. Right. And the role of storytellers within community. And it's told from this point of view and the line that I always remember is about the narrator traveling to renew their supply of stories.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is such myth, and which was something that was so important to Jim, the idea that we constantly need to reinvent myth for the present, to tell stories that will help us and tell the truth about the place that we are. And yeah,
well, he says, I went west to renew my supply of stories. So he's talking about, you know, the narrator moving from the East Coast to San Francisco, where the story takes place. And that, you know, of course, that's, you know, Huck Finn. And, you know, that there's such a sort of lucid American literary sensibility sort of embedded in that sense. And, it, you know, it very much picks up on what Albert Murray wrote about in his first book, The Omni-Americans, where he says that he believes that, you know, all Americans should treat Nat Turner and Harriet Tubman as our central founding national figures. And I think, you know, that's, to me, that's still, you know, this is, we're talking about almost 50 years later. To me, that's still a, such a provocative and important idea.
One of the things about that, the story, also is that, you know, he's talking about an interracial couple and whether or not, and also their child, and whether or not their race determines their fate.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, it relates back to what we're talking about. Do you have a choice to transcend that?
Precisely, it's entirely a story about fate.
And so your novel, your terrific novel, Your Face and Mine, in a way, is also a meditation on whether or not a person's race determines their fate, or can a person change their fate by changing their race or gain agency. I wonder if you could just talk about the premise behind that novel and maybe read a passage from it.
Yeah, so the basic premise of the novel is that the narrator is a white man in his 30s, who discovers that his childhood best friend, who he hasn't seen for 20 years, and who was a white teenager when he last saw him, is now a black man in his 30s who is has been completely transformed, and you know, as if by magic, as if by waving a wand. And in fact, what's happened is that his friend underwent a crisis that he calls racial dysphoria, and decided that he was transracial, that he was actually a black man inside, and then went to Thailand and found a kind of a incredibly skillful surgeon who transformed him into a black man. Okay, well, this moment in the novel, this is early in the novel, and the narrator, whose name is Kelly, is very much an autobiographical character. This is a chapter where he's essentially reflecting on his own past as a white teenager living in Baltimore, very much involved in political activism and also involved with this food pantry. In this passage, he's talking about his relationship with the man, an African-American man in his 40s, who ran the food pantry and lived at the food pantry, whose name is James. He was a Muslim, though he rarely discussed it, not Nation of Islam, but NBIM, which he told me once stood for New Baltimore Integrated Mosque, a special congregation where Arabs and Pakistanis and black people all worship together. Occasionally, if I arrived early enough, I found him doing morning prayers outside in the empty lot next to the food pantry's row house. Inshallah, he always said, when we talked about how many bags we distribute that day, and Alan and I started doing it too as a joke first and then without thinking. Inshallah, we could sell 15 t-shirts. Inshallah, if you get into Wesleyan. It happened to be in the same moment that I came to know James that I read the autobiography of Malcolm X for the first time and came upon the rapper Paris, who referred casually to blue-eyed devils and sons of Yaqub as if talking about his Uncle Bill from Indiana. At the Black Cat bookstore in Reed Street, I found copies of The Final Call and the New African Party newsletter, and I sat reading for an entire Sunday afternoon, one column of tiny print after another, mesmerized by explanations of how the downfall of white America, with three Ks, could be predicted by the phases of the sun, how school health clinics and Planned Parenthood were agents of genocide, how black people could use shea butter to boost their natural immunity to AIDS. There was something refreshing about being called a devil. This was in 1991, at the very peak of the crack wars, when Baltimore was murder capital for the first time. I'd just gotten my license and I drove myself alone, or sometimes with Alan, down to the food pantry twice or three times a week. And the fact of being independent changed everything I saw, as if I had to own the city for the first time, having to find my own parking spaces in it. It wasn't a matter of fear, though I carried mace with me everywhere, wore my wallet and keys on a biker chain, and checked the back seat and trunk of the car religiously, as carjackers were known to put a gun to your head from behind as you drove. What astonished me was how easily I could slip past the box hedges and pin oaks of Roland Park, the Victorians and Colonials and Tudors prim and quiet, into the derelict corridors, the bombed-out storefronts, the vacants, the dealers in puffy jackets standing sentry on every corner, the Korean liquor stores with armor grates and triple-thick glass in front of the register. This was a drive of 10 minutes. It's still, come to think of it, a drive of 10 minutes. This geography, I thought, was a crime. Someone had given me a postcard of Proudhon that I taped to my locker. Property is theft. How could it be anything else? How could I be anything other than a criminal by the fact of my pimply existence?
Jess, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, we've been fortunate to have really great conversations on this podcast and talking to you. I feel like immediately running back to my desk and writing, which is wonderful.
Jess.
All right. Well, thank you guys. This was really fun.
And now we're thrilled to be joined by acclaimed poet, memoirist, and critic, Megan O'Rourke. Megan is the author of the memoir, The Long Goodbye, and the poetry collections Half-Life, Once, and most recently, Sun and Days. She writes frequently about illness and health, among other subjects. Megan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's so great to have you here, and congratulations on Sun and Days. We were neighbors for about a year a few years ago, and I've missed our conversations about writing and life and the subject of this episode, fate.
Did you guys really talk about fate with each other? Seriously? Like, as friends?
Yes, we actually did. Although I appreciate your skepticism.
I know. I was quiet because I was just taking that in, and I was like, it's true. We did talk about fate, among other less substantial things, let's say.
But I think that's really cool. I'm trying to think if I had friends that I talked about fate with. I don't know. All right, so look, when we think about how much control we have over our lives and what might be predetermined and how we tell ourselves a story of our own power and agency, I think of your 2008 poem, My Life as a Subject. How did you come to write that poem? And maybe could you read it for us?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to read the poem. I'm so glad you picked that poem because it's one of my favorite poems. If one is allowed to have a favorite poem, one is written. Mostly one has, unfavored pieces of writing that one has written. But actually,
this here is my least favorite thing I've ever written.
This is the one that makes me cringe the most now. That poem, it's partly been on my mind because it is very much in my mind a political poem, although it's written as a kind of fable or allegory, and it might be easy to miss the politics of it. But it was a poem I wrote in the early 2000s under the George W. Bush presidency, thinking about, in particular, what prompted that poem was thinking about the presence of Guantanamo and what felt to me like my silent acquiescence in it, even though I wasn't really feeling acquiescence to this. And so it's been very interesting to think about this poem for me in terms of the presidency we're under now. That's why it's been definitely on my mind. What does it mean to be both the subject of one's own life in the sense of the first person teller and also subject in a civic landscape that you're not entirely, it's not the one you would choose necessarily. My life as a subject, and it's in parts. One, because I was born in a kingdom, there was a king. At times, the king was a despot. At other times, not. Axes flashed in the road at night, but if you closed your eyes, sitting on the well edge amongst your kinspeople and sang the ballad, then the silver did not appear to be broken. Such were the circumstances. They made a liar out of me. Did they change my spirit? Kiss in the night, the cry of owls, a bird fight. Two. We also had a queen wetted by the moon, and we her subjects softening in her sight. Three, what one had, the other had to have too. Soon parrots bloomed in every garden, and every daughter had a tuning fork jeweled with emeralds. Four, learning to hunt in the new empire, the king invited his subjects to send him their knives. He tested these knives on oranges, pomegranates, acorn squash, soft birches, stillborns, prisoners who had broken rules. He used them on the teeth of traitors. Five. When strangers massed at the border, the courtiers practiced subjection of the foreign. The court held a procession of twine, rope, gold, knives, and prostitutes with their vials of white powder. Smoke coursed into the courtyard, and we wrought hunger upon the bodies of strangers. I am sure you can imagine it. Really, what need is there for me to tell you? You were a stranger once, too, and I brought rope. Six. Afterward, I slept and let the dealers come to me alone with their jewels and their powders. 7. At night, we debated the skin of language, questioned what might be revealed inside, a soft pink fruit, a woman in a field, or a shadow, sticky and loose as old jam. Our own dialect was abstract. We wished to understand not how things were, but what spectacle we might make from them. 8. One day a merchant came to court and brought moving pictures, the emperor's new delight. He tacked dark cloth to the windows and turned off the lights, cranking the machine and the film like a needle and thread, making stories we could insinuate our cold bodies into and find warmth. Light, dark, and the sliding images of courtiers merrily balancing monkeys on their heads as if this were an adequate story. 9. And our queen, that hidden self, what became of her? Slid into the night like a statue, shivered into shadows, knowing as a spider in retreat, the web her mind, and in it the fly. 10. On Sundays, we flew kites to ensure our joy was seen by those who threatened to threaten us. The thread spooling out high in the purple sky and silver gelatin films being made, sliding through the cranking machine so that the barbarians could know we made images of ourselves coated in precious metal and sent them away, indifferent to our wealth. I miss the citrus smell of spring on the plaza filled with young and long-limbed kite flyers. 11. Do I have anything to add? Only that I obeyed my king, my kind. I was not faithless. Should I be punished for that? It is true, the pictures creaking through the spindle cause me pain. I know the powder we coated our fingers with made us thirsty and sometimes cruel. But I was born with a spirit like you. I have woken, you see, and I wish to be made new.
Oh, thank you. I love that poem so much.
Thank you.
You wrote this poem, of course, as you were mentioning pre-Trump.
Yeah.
And under the Bush presidency, and now to return to some of these ideas about what it means to be, quote unquote, a subject. You know, I feel so much more a cog in the machine than I did even back in 2008. I think I've always felt like that to some degree. And I wonder, I continue to wonder how to write about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I do too. And it's really hard to know because one doesn't want to feel merely topical as a writer, I think, as a literary writer, right? I mean, in my nonfiction, I'm very happy to be sometimes merely topical, you know, moment of the day. But certainly in my poems and my literary nonfiction, one wants to feel, you know, I want to feel that I'm writing something that, you know, can sort of stand beyond the moment of its circumstances, beyond the moment of its making. And there's something about what's happening right now. And that, you know, that feels so particularly insane and bonkers and therefore of its own era, you know, in a way that's probably quite in contrast to a topic like fate, which feels, you know, universal and big and all of that. But maybe it was our fate to arrive in this insane moment that we can't make more of.
Well, I mean, you had that line in there, which to me is the sort of the key question that we're kind of working on today is, you know, I obeyed my king. Should I be punished for that?
Right.
You know, what do you think?
Well, you know, without giving it away, I definitely think this speaker is much more complicit than she thinks she is.
Right.
I mean, I was really interested in writing a poem. You know, I think as a poet, I'm sometimes frustrated by my proximity to the autobiographical I, which obviously no one is forcing me into, but there's something about the way I write poems that does, you know, I do tend to write, you know, a slightly constructed I. I would say all of my first person speakers are slightly fictional to me, at least, or they're fictions in the sense that they're made objects, made literary verbal artifacts. But I really was interested in writing during this time, a first person who who found a lot of herself, who is opaque to herself in some ways.
Are you saying that the first person narrator is not always exactly the same as the author?
Newsflash.
What
right.
is Shockingly. Happening?
Shockingly, yes. Especially in poems. And actually when you write, I think especially, I'm going to wager something. I think especially as a young woman writing poems, you are really associated with your first person. In my first book in particular, every poem was taken as autobiographical and a lot of them were really fictions of sort of literary fictions. But yeah, so I was really interested in this question of like, should we be punished for that? Like we sort of make talk ourselves into something with, you know, what we think are the right intention, you know, how much are we responsible for what we do not see? Right. And I think this is a very relevant, you know, question at the moment. And it's a really relevant question in all sorts of ways, not just toward, you know, politics and Trump and sort of, you know, national politics, but towards, I think, how we treat one another as individuals and groups. And it's still very much, you know, this is still a question I'm haunted by.
I think fundamentally, that was the reason that I decided to become a reporter and embed in Iraq and try to write about the war, was that I felt a complicity for its beginning, even though I hadn't, you know, it wasn't my idea.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I almost, in a weird way, I almost felt more complicity under the Bushes than I do now, I think because I'm just so...
And a war is such a particular thing that's being inflicted on another group of people. I think it's also sort of more explicit in some ways.
I think that's really important to remember. And, you know, one does see a kind of liberal, oh, Trump is so much worse than Bush, you know, assessment being made sometimes somewhat cavalierly on Twitter. And, you know, I think that's, you know, we really have to, there was a, you know, Bush is, you know, George W. waged a really damaging war that, you know, the consequences of which we are still totaling up, right? And it maybe wasn't, the effects of it maybe weren't felt stateside, but they were felt in Iraq, right? They were felt in Afghanistan. And to me, that sense of complicity haunts me to this day as a writer. So how do we turn that into, how do we turn that into art as writers in a way that doesn't feel, you know, kind of self-involved or just like, oh, you know, or sort of virtue signaling, to use a term that I really like, that's, you know, kind of in use now, you know, how do we really make that into a deeply embedded question in a poem? And I think it comes back to the fact that we all have moments in our lives where we think we're doing something. You know, we tell ourselves a lot of this poem is about what kind of stories we tell ourselves as individuals and groups, right? The idea of story comes back in periodically. And that's something I'm still interested in. But, you know, we tell ourselves stories in order to live, Joan Didion said, but we also tell ourselves stories. I think part of what she meant is we also tell ourselves stories in order to feel better about how we live.
Well, and it's at the end of the poem, it's sort of that section 11 is almost a confession. Do I have anything else to add?
Right.
Right. Which is how I think about that. And you ask, how much are we responsible for what we don't see? And then the very last lines, I have woken, you see, suggest that seeing is a choice that we can make, that the speaker is coming to a realization about.
Yeah. She's also quite tricky because she wants to be forgiven.
Right.
Right.
Right. She really wants to be forgiven. So she wants to be like, I mean, it's actually interesting in the context of the way the word woke is used now, right? I mean, I wasn't thinking.
Yeah, that's what I was exactly what I was thinking. And which I don't think was particularly in vogue at the time that you wrote the poem.
No, not at all. Not at all. Certainly, you know, I wasn't woke enough to know if it was.
Right.
Yeah.
So you wrote about...
No, that's exactly what this is about, is that kind of awakening. And then like, but what kinds of responsibilities do we drag with us, even if we do wake? And then how much are we kind of still wanting to, like, you know, exonerate ourselves in a way that's you know, a little bit, you know, a little bit problematic, to use a word that's overused.
You wrote a little bit about Me Too recently for the New York Times Magazine. And there you talked about how the bystander effect created an environment that made sexual harassment and abuse possible for years. So the quote, you know, in which people are less likely to offer help to someone in distress if there are other people present, especially if the others are passive.
Wow, that's such a great connection. I hadn't thought about these two pieces in connection to each other, but it's true that that piece of journalism is in a way very, very deeply connected to this poem. So I guess I'm seeing my own preoccupations emerge. But yeah, I mean, I've been really haunted by my own sense of complicity, right? Not just thinking about the things that I experienced that I wish I hadn't had to experience as a subject, but actually the moments when I normalized and the people whose behavior I normalized for years, right? And I was really haunted thinking the reason I wrote that piece was that there were a couple of people in my life in particular who some of whom I was, you know, are now dead actually, but I was quite close to, and some of whom were still peers of mine who, you know, I sort of stood by and watched a lot of behavior that now I think, well, why was I doing that, right? So it's really fascinating how other people's presence changes how we see the world.
A lot of my work, as you know, is very interested in militancy in the Tamil community, both inside Sri Lanka and outside Sri Lanka. And, you know, sort of taking account of the ways in which I learned initially to read about that conflict, and then considering the ways in which I had failed to see things that were omitted or left out, and like sort of calling on myself to do a more rigorous kind of reading that allowed me to see a more complete picture. And then also kind of acknowledging that quite likely I am failing repeatedly to see complete pictures, because no one is ever giving you the complete picture. So the kind of homework that is required, or the kind of rigor to see the whole thing, you know, I was really, I think the early stories that I read and saw about the Tamil Tigers, who I frequently write about, were very much in favor of their tactics and history and mission. And those stories like left a huge amount out. And I think a lot of, I'm interested in accounting for that, I think in some way, while also looking at the fact that I remain critical of the state, that there are other players, you know, often we've talked a lot on the show about binaries of good and evil. And one of the things I like about your poem is that it takes this setting, right? You know, the king and his subjects. And we often think of that framework as kind of, it's a fable, and so its nuance is necessarily flattened. And, but you take the setting and make it really complex. And I think it's easy to, I don't know, if you look at, when I think of stories I read as a child about, oh, the tyrannical king and the people who rose up against them, or I don't really think about the people who failed to rise up against them, right? That wasn't the story that we were paying attention to. Right.
I think there's a reason why this poem seems important now. And also, you know, Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale has been made into this, you know, very successful show now. And there seem to me some echoes between the narrator in your poem is more complicit, less having something done to her, right? Mm-hmm. But there's still this sense of living under a sort of occupation in a way, that seems important.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I was trying to convey, and I hope that it's in there a little bit, that, you know, she probably would have died, right? There's a real violence in the world around her, and there is a way in which I think she felt, at least the speaker feels at least, that she would have died, right? If she hadn't, she kind of had to do this in some sense, which, you know, is partly justification and partly probably true. Or that's, you know, insofar as I kind of know the speaker, that's how I end up thinking about her. But yeah, I mean, The Handmaid's Tale just feels so incredibly relevant. And I think because it does really reckon with that same, I think I was trying to reckon with also, what do the days feel like under occupation?
Yeah, I was also reminded a little bit of course, of the lottery.
Yeah.
You know, you were a stranger once too, and I brought rope.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
And then I go back to wondering about fate. I mean, isn't it just like the idea that I could be on the other side of that line, that I am the stranger, and sometimes I am the stranger, right? That is so, that's in some ways accidents of history.
Yeah.
And it's curious to think about, I don't know, how to contend with that. If a character, and we also had an episode where we talked about Trump and Shakespeare, right? And we talked about Macbeth, and we talked about Hamlet a little bit. And, you know, when I think about my own tragic flaws, and the older I get, the more I think I'm probably slightly aware of them in ways that maybe I would even prefer not to be, right? Like that narrative that, like, I am my own fate. Am I choosing, or was I born this way? Right. Like, I was reading a few days ago this piece about Bill Cosby on The Atlantic, which was sort of talking about how the pound cake speech helped lead to his downfall. And right. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of narrative of, there was no way,
for Bill, justice was going to come for Bill Cosby, which is definitely a story I prefer. And yet also, of course, it took the choices of many, many, many individual people to hold him to account.
Yeah, so obviously fate is such a huge and overwhelming topic. And I was thinking about two things, knowing that we were going to touch on it at least. And one was the etymology of fate, which is really fascinating to me, which has to, it comes from a Latin word for speaking, right? Which I had not known until recently. I sort of came across it for something else I was working on.
This is why we bring the poets on for the language.
And the daughter of the classicist, right? Like he's always trained me to, my father was a classicist. And yeah, so I'm actually writing a little section about fate in the nonfiction book I'm working on, so about the Greek fates. So I had looked it up, but it means, you know, that which has been spoken. It's a past tense. We bring it from, in particular, the past tense of the Latin word, which is to speak, which is fari. And then fatum is that which has been spoken, which is just fascinating, right? This idea. So I think in terms of thinking about writing and your point, Sugi, about like, you know, how when we tell a story about, you know, Cosby and Me Too, like at what point do we think, well, that was always going to have been spoken, right? And at what point is also does the act of speaking and storytelling change what is spoken? And the other kind of, you know, concept of fate that is fascinating to me is one that's less psychological, which is not so much that we are our own fates, but just that events hit us and change us, right? Which is not a very 21st century kind of understanding of fate. We like to think, especially in America, of ourselves as the shapers of fate, even if it's a fatal flaw. We kind of like, in some way, I think, the idea that it's our own fatal flaw that's leading to our downfall, as opposed to, you know, the random fate that the fates give you when they cut the threads when you're born, you know, which is the myth of the Greek fates. You know, as soon as you're born, your thread is already, they spin your thread and they cut it at the same time, which is such a devastating idea.
Well, there's that, you know, that Calvinism is a part of the American religious tradition that thinks about predestination and fate. And it's sort of always in tension with our idea of individualism and individual action. You know, I'm not going to open up this subject, but you know, Marilynne Robinson has written quite a bit about Calvinism, and also I took a class once where she talked about Calvinism in Melville and particularly in Moby Dick that was amazing. Yeah.
She's amazing. I feel like she's like the last Calvinist, though. Do you know what I mean?
Maybe that's true. But those things, like, I think she would argue that the idea is still it's still there in our culture. We don't maybe recognize it consciously.
Yeah. She's obviously right. But I do sometimes worry that the like Thoreauvian model has, I think we could probably do with a little more Calvinism.
Maybe.
Calvinist myself. Actually, I hate Calvin. You know, I hate the idea of predestination personally. It makes me bridle. And I remember studying it in school and being like, this is just so wrong. But it might be a useful kind of.
Well, one of the interesting things about the way Calvinism has been used historically is to say, because Calvin said you could be predestined to be saved, but also predestined to be damned. If you think about it, you know, like the way the Dutch thought about, Dutch settlers in South Africa thought that you know, the people who lived there, who were from South Africa, were destined to be damned, right, because of Calvinism. It was used to justify racism, but also it can be used to justify misogyny and sexism, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what's terrifying, I think, to the 21st, you know, anyone who kind of came of age in an era of, you know, postmodernism and thinking about the historical contingency of the perspective of that, you know, the absolute, you know, even if one has sort of a sneaking affection as I do for certain kinds of absolute values like beauty, you know, I think when you think about something that any kind of thought system that believes it knows everything, right, that believes that there's something fixed to begin with, it's we've seen how dangerous that is, how easily we can use it against one another. It's like fated, you know, as if those systems are fated to be poorly used.
Well, I mean, in a way, you hear it in the language of the people, of the harassers, and you know, when you're looking at Harvey Weinstein or somebody like that, that like the people, their victims were wanted to participate anyway and were destined to participate.
You write, of course, about bodies and health, and I'm curious about how you think about individual and collective power and free will broadly in your work. In addition to that, in genetics, the language of talking about genetics, which has become really popular, you know, to test one's own family history, et cetera, et cetera, has become really popular in recent years. And people often talk about genetics as a, you know, genetics are our fate. Mm-hmm. And this is a theme of Sun and Days.
I'm really in Sun and Days and in this nonfiction book about illness that I'm working on now, I'm really trying to dig up and complicate some of the buckets of thinking we have about the mind and the body and fate and genetics. And, you know, if every era has its governing scientific, you know, kind of poorly understood scientific idea by which it measures everything, right? I mean, heredity and genetics was probably the late 19th century, and then in different ways, more sophisticated ways, the 20th century. And yeah, I actually think really now we're seeing that it's something, it's not just genetics, but also what scientists call epigenetics that matter, which is mm-hmm. to say, I think we're moving into an era in science and medicine where we understand that, you know, Lamarck was more right than maybe we thought he was, right? That actually how life comes at us and affects us, some of which is characterological and some of which is like a virus or a bacterial infection, right? Or a war. How that all hits us sort of changes our expression of our genes, right? And ways that can last for generations. So, mm-hmm. you know, to me, this is very rich for the writer. And it kind of corresponds to what I feel is true as a writer, which is that there are givens, or what I like to feel is true, right? There are givens, but there is some way in which we can negotiate around givens. But it's such an American desire, right? To be like, just do it, right? Like, just will yourself through the moment. And a lot of Sun and Days is about trying to reckon with the fact that there are experiences we can't will ourselves out of. And we don't like to talk about that, right? And illness is one of them. And we don't like to look at, you know, it resonates in so many directions in terms of thinking about privilege and class and race, but, you know, in the body, like we don't, until I got sick, other people's illnesses were very obscure to me, right? Other people's disabilities were sort of, I understood they were there, but I took them as fated in some way that made me think that the person who was experiencing it, just that was their life, right? And then when I got sick, you know, it was such an awakening for me to realize, oh no, any person in any subjectivity is always struggling with that subjectivity, that subject position, right? You know what I mean? So I was really trying to write poems that, and lyric essays in that book that really explored, you know, what is coherent about us? You know, what does remain when under duress, you know, in war, with a bacterial infection that invades your nervous system and your brain, which is what happened to me. I had Lyme disease that became very seriously neurological and completely changed who I was. And yet there was some, as I talk about it, kind of low pilot flame that kept saying, no, 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 this is not who you are. It's some other you, right? Which did suggest kind of coherent I.
I love that image of a low pilot flame. That's really great. So interesting, that sense of exterior events. I guess my closest thing, since I have not been ill in that way, was what you were talking, though, what it reminded me of was sitting in a Humvee waiting to go outside of the gates of a base in 2006 when I knew that it was really, really dangerous and people could get blown up and killed very easily, and that might happen to me, and feeling how stupid it was that I was doing that. Like, how could I be participating in this? This isn't me. I'm not doing this. There's some part of me that says that I can't actually really be doing this. It was a very strange dissonance.
That's really, and I think one way that we sometimes find ways around that is by having a witness. And I mean, Meg, I remember the year that we were living in very close proximity, like a floor apart from each other. I was inexplicably sick a couple times. And you sort of said very generously, like, do you want me to come to the doctor with you? And eventually it resolved sort of pretty smoothly. But it was also just sort of this feeling of, I was sort of like, Megan would see me if a doctor didn't see me, Megan would be my witness so that I could believe my own story about that, who I am, and whether that is changing in some moment.
And that's, I think, why we read. I mean, really, that is what books become for us. And I did read a ton of illness memoirs during this period, and they were very, really comforting to me, you know, not in just a pure kind of therapeutic level, but in a deeply existential, almost metaphysical level, right? That like, no, we can, this act of trying to put very confusing and complicated experiences into language is really one of the profound acts of witness we have. And it really is meaningful in times like these.
Well, speaking of reading, maybe you could read one more poem for us to send off this episode, maybe like on the theme of illness.
Absolutely. So I'll read a poem called Idiopathic Illness, which is really on the topic that we're talking about. It's idiopathic is the medical word for we don't know what's wrong with you. This is idiopathic illness. I threw hollowed self at your robust, went for IV drips, mercury detoxes, cilantro smoothies. I pressed my lips to you, fed you kale, spooned down coconut oil. I fasted for blood sugar, underboomed the carbs, chased ketosis, urine stripped and slip checked, baked raw cocoa and mint, and masticated pig thyroids. You were contemporary, toxic. I can't remember what you were. You're in my brain, inflaming it, using up the glutathione. I read about you on the internet and my doctor agreed. Just take more, he urged, and more. You slipped into each cell. I went after you with a thinking inside and medical mushrooms for maximum oom. I plumbed you without getting to nevermore. Oh, doom. You were a disease without name. I was a body gone flame. Together we twitched, and the acupuncturist said, it looks difficult. Stay calmish. What can be said? I came without a warranty. Stripped of me or me-ishness, I was a will in a subpar body. I waxed toward all that waned inside.
Ah, so good. Oh, doom.
Oh, doom. Well, there's fate, right?
Megan, thanks so much for being on the show with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, you guys.
It was really great. And to all our listeners, stay calmish out there. I feel like I'm going to repeat that to myself all day. Well, we'll really look forward to reading the nonfiction book as well, and Sun and Days, and we will post links to those poems on our website. Thanks again, Meg.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman, and that other music we played? Yep, you guessed it. It's from The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen, which I bought and still own on the original vinyl, a fact that fatefully does not impress my kids. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorites podcast app. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the News tab. We'll post a link to the books we referenced this week on our LitHub show page, on Facebook at FNF Pod, and on Twitter at FNF Talk. Happy reading. Hey, rate us on iTunes.